Good afternoon, Hare Krishna. This is my first time in Sweden. Never been here before, so this is a lot of fun for me. Why don't we, I don't bite, so why don't we move up here a little bit? It's just get everyone up here a little bit, moving forward, and this will be very much nicer for me. That way I can see everyone. Everyone can be comfortable. Is this good? Not so bad, right? I promise, I won't hurt anyone. Okay, good. Good. Usually it's nice to read something from one of Prabhupada's books. I picked up Bhagavad Gita here, and it was all in Sweden, Swedish. So I'm no good in speaking or reading Swedish, so it'll have to be English. Is there...
We normally have...
some.
Yes.
Over there.
Oh, there it is. Yeah. Good. Great. Let me just. Is there a verse on which anyone would like me to speak? Any particular verse? Then we'll just open up to something. It's, okay. A very famous verse from the Bhagavad Gita. Well, it's good to see you. Okay. Verse from the Bhagavad Gita. I'll just repeat it in the Sanskrit and read. Ye yata mam prapadyante tangsta taiva bhajam yaham. Mama vartmanu vartante manushya partha sarvashaha. As all surrender unto me, I reward them accordingly. Everyone follows my path in all respects. O son of Pritha, thank you. Purport. Everyone is searching for God or Krishna in the different aspects of his manifestations. Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is partially realized in his impersonal Brahmajyoti effulgence and as the all-pervading supersoul dwelling within everything, including the particles of atoms. But Krishna is fully realized only by his pure devotees. Consequently, Krishna is the object of everyone's realization, and thus anyone and everyone is satisfied according to one's desire to have him. In the transcendental world also, Krishna reciprocates with his pure devotees in the transcendental attitude, just as the devotee wants him. One devotee may want Krishna as supreme master, another as his personal friend, another as his son, and still another as his lover. Krishna rewards all the devotees equally according to their different intensities of love for him. In the material world, the same reciprocations of feelings are there, and they are equally exchanged by the Lord with the different types of worshippers. The pure devotees, both here and in the transcendental abode, associate with him in person and are able to render personal service to the Lord and thus derive transcendental bliss in his loving service. This is a long purport, and there's so much to comment on just here that I cannot bear to go further. Well, first of all, I will mention that my name is Garuda Das, and probably many of you don't know who I am, so maybe I should say just a couple of things. One of the reasons, I mean, the main reason I'm here is to work with Pranavaji at the university. He has had the strange karma to have me as his doctoral dissertation advisor, which is sort of an historical moment in a way, because I don't think there's any instance in which a Prabhupada Shishya would be advising another bhakta in the academic context. So here we are in a devotional context, and then over at the University of, here we go, You got the bori? How was that? I've been practicing. Uh-huh. Oh, thank you. Yes, thank you. Okay, that's plenty. Withhold the applause. Thank you. It's been really a pleasure to work with Pranavaji on this wonderful topic on which he is concentrating the great contributions the powerful and significant accomplishments, achievements of Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur. So this is quite a project, and I think it will be a very great contribution. In some sense, taking a total picture or a very comprehensive picture of Bhaktisiddhanta's life and achievements in a particular time in history in India, and seeing his accomplishments as as antecedents of what we are experiencing right now. Very powerful antecedents, seeds. I like that. It's sort of in the word antecedents. Seedens. Okay, we've got that in the word to play with words. But so that is my primary purpose in coming. My background is Srila Prabhupada, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, wanted certain disciples to establish an understanding amongst the academics and the intelligentsia. What is bhakti? What is devotion? What is this kind of yoga? What is this special form, this highest form of yoga, as is explained in the Bhagavad Gita? So this is a task that Srila Prabhupada gave to certain disciples. And so I was one of the early ones that started back into the university, get some training. At this point, I'm sort of an overeducated idiot. I have too many degrees, and it took me a very long time because I'm not so smart. And so it took me quite a while. And so back in the old days, there was no way to know who would be doing this work. So my advisors said, go to the biggest and the best. We don't know how many people will be doing this, so go to the biggest and the best. So I got my PhD at Harvard. I think it's known name over here, isn't it? Harvard University. So in America, that's considered, it's sort of the symbol of the best. And so it was quite a haul. I have two master's degrees from Harvard and a doctorate in comparative religion. And so this has been my work, and my specialization is in Indian studies, and the dissertation for which I the dissertation I wrote for completing the doctorate at Harvard ended up being a book, which is right here, published by Princeton University Press, called Dance of Divine Love. And it was a long process. I'd like to speak a little bit today about what is going on in this book, which can be easily understood and easily misunderstood at the same time. But hopefully I've supplied enough in the book itself to be able to understand it. But I think it bears some discussion and so on. The painting on the front, by the way, is part of a much larger painting. It's a detail of the center of a Ras Mandala painting that I commissioned for this book, for this very book. And in the as the frontispiece, they put it in a kind of grayscale presentation. I asked them to do it in color, but they said then we'll raise the cost of the book too much. So these technical things go on. Dance of Divine Love, the Ras Lila of Krishna from the Bhagavad Purana, India's classic sacred love story, introduced, translated, and illuminated. why does Garuda Das or Dr. Graham Schweig, or professor, however they call you in the academic world, why does he focus on the Ras Lila? From the devotional side, it's almost an audacious thing to do. An absolutely presumptuous, audacious, we've been warned by Srila Prabhupada. No one should jump to the highest vision. The Ras Lila is the highest vision of supreme love in the Vaishnava tradition, in the ancient Vaishnava texts. It's the most hallowed, the most revered, the most honored and sacred text. And Srila Prabhupada warned us that to jump to this would be not healthy, not good. It is rather something that should be progressed to, something that, as we know, that the Bhagavad Purana, in which the five chapters of the Ras Lila exist, the Bhagavad Purana has 335 chapters. I think you have some of the books here, but 335 chapters, of which five are considered the very pinnacle, the very high point, the ultimate statement of the whole Bhagavad. And those five are situated within the 10th canto, the 10th book, of a text that is comprised of 12 books containing 335 chapters. It is a very grand work, a very beautiful work. So my original dissertation work began with the idea not of doing a treatment, a translation and treatment of the Ras Lila. Never even occurred to me to do such a thing. I mean, who would do such a thing, right? So it was initially, as I mentioned, my doctorate was in comparative religion. Srila Prabhupada was very keen on understanding how Vaishnavism connected with and spoke to other religious traditions. There are many letters, there are many statements in the books and so on. And so I always thought of it as my task to figure out how to do that. And so I was going to compare certain forms of Christian and Vaishnava mysticism, love mysticism, and how they related. And I was going to look at Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami, along with the works of San Juan de la Cruz, St. John of the Cross. They were roughly contemporaneous, 16th century renunciates, who had a profound ability to write on such deep subject matters as love of God and how that seemed to be powerfully experienced within each of their respective traditions. So when pursuing this comparative work with my advisor, he slowly came to the conclusion that there was plenty of stuff on the Christian side, there was very little on the Vaishnava side. And so one day he confronted me. He said, "No, stop. What is the highest vision of the Vaishnava side? What is the highest statement of yoga, if you will? What is the highest vision of supreme love for the Vaishnavas?" And I sat there and I said, and I thought a little bit, and I said, well, and I might have said well a third time, for all I know. I said it would have to be the Ras Lila. He said, "So has this been treated?" And I said, "Well, of course. Everyone, all the scholars talk about it. Everyone knows about it. It must be the case." He said, "Show me." So he said, "Don't come back until you can show me that." So I scoured the libraries at Harvard. And, you know, Harvard's a very spread out campus, many libraries. There's a main library, Widener Library, but there are many libraries. And it takes a long time just to walk around to the libraries, what to speak of, get in and find the books and so on. But I spent a month doing that, and I came up with zero. In fact, I found that people talk about it as if they know about it, but they really don't know about it, and they talk about it anyway. So I came in sort of sheepishly. I said, "Actually, no one has really done anything with it." And he looked at me like, "Well, I think that's where you need to focus. So that's where I focused. So I went to the traditional commentaries of the Goswamis and to become a little more enlightened on this subject matter. And because it's such a grave subject matter and such a lofty lila, I took quite a bit of time. It took me about 10, 11 years to come out with this, you know, one 440-page book. Everyone was looking at me a little strangely that it would take so long to write a book, but it took me quite some time. So what I'd like to mention to you, here in this verse, and I'll link the two, here the question of, there's a major statement being made here in this verse in the Bhagavad Gita and in the purport that follows it, is that God loves souls. And we are in a sort of state of, in some sense, of receiving a kind of unrequited love. God loves us, but the question is, and he keeps loving us, the question is, do we love him? And he's very accommodating. In this verse and purport, we read that however we love him, he will reciprocate. So, he loves us completely, but withholds much of that expression to us. He doesn't want to pressure us, you know. But however we do love him, he'll reciprocate that immediately, you see. I think everyone's probably had a grandparent who just loved, showered us with love as a little grandchild, and it's like, it was frightening. Oh, did any of you have that experience? I don't know. With me, my grandmother, she loved me so much, it was just terrifying. Walking in the door was like the scariest experience of my childhood, because I knew my cheeks would be pinched, and she would look at me almost, it felt as if an attack dog was about to be. Yeah, no, it was just like that. That's exactly how I responded, just in that way, exactly. Yeah, so it was always very difficult. So with Krishna, he knows not to do that. He knows to hold back a little bit, and then to try to make it very reciprocal, not to be so imbalanced or lopsided, like my grandmother. So in the story of the Ras Lila, we have here, no doubt, the most exquisite and most beautiful statement of supreme love in the Vaishnava tradition. And while Srila Prabhupada warned us that it is a very lofty thing, it also has some incredibly important lessons for anybody. It turns out to be a lila, really, for anybody. And in fact, it says in the very last verse, maybe I should read it. I have my glasses on. I'm looking for my glasses. My glasses. This is called a continuing jet lag. You see? The effects of continued jet lag. The last verse of the Rasa Panchadhyayi goes like this. This is the divine play of Vishnu with the fair maidens of Vraj. One who is filled with faith, who hears or describes this play, having regained the highest devotion for the beloved Lord, has lust, the disease of the heart, quickly removed without delay. Such a person is peaceful and wise. So, Hrid Rogam, the disease of the heart. Isn't this what bhakti is all about? Purifying the heart, being able to love fully, to experience a fullness of heart and be able to offer this to the Supreme. This is what bhakti is about. It is about trying to purify and to rid the heart of inebrieties of any kind so the heart can love fully. I think we all can recognize the hurts of the heart. Different times, different phases, different events in our lives, there's always the hurt accompanying the heart. And those things need to somehow be processed. Those things need to be purified in our hearts. Not repressed, not shunned, not ignored, but rather, in some sense, processed, pursued, understanding the nature of love. Sometimes very deep hurts produce a greater depth of the heart. Sometimes disappointments in love can entreat us to search for love, greater forms of love. In the Ras Lila, we have a picture painted of supreme love. The whole reason why one meditates on supreme love is to, in some sense, have our hearts attain that fully. And in the process, in terms of the bhakti process, especially with the repetition of the sacred names of God, chanted either with discipline or out of love, those names are chanted to purify us. The image of the Ras Mandala is there to purify. It is to give us access, greater access to the divine heart and to our own hearts, and to the hearts of others. So if there's one amazing function of a place like this, it would be the heart hospital. How about that? The hospital of the heart. Here we will, you know, take care of hurt hearts. We will give the greatest medicine for such hearts, which is the ultimate picture of supreme love. We have also Krishna with the cowherd maidens, I think. Is that the cowherd? Yes, cowherd maidens are there. The Vraja Gopikas, who are considered to be the greatest reciprocators of the divine heart. Interestingly enough, they're all feminine. So these are great yoginis who are utterly in love with Krishna, who is Yogeshwara, the supreme lord of yoga, as is described in this lila. And so in some sense, we all are here to learn the yoga of the heart. The yoga of the heart. I mean, plain and simple, it is the yoga of the heart that we are here to practice. It is not like the hatha yoga. You know, hatha means exertion, forced. We could do that here. Okay, I want everyone to get in lotus position now. Okay, so for some people that will be a little bit forced, right? Yeah. So you put one leg on the other, and you know this is a little forced, but the heart, you never have to force the heart. The heart, oh, it is natural for the heart to love. The question is, what is the best environment for the heart? We are most naturally loving, very loving souls. That's the way we were made. We are endowed with a natural propensity toward prema, or pure love. That gets covered by the hurts. That gets covered by the conditionings. And so it's a process of trying to find our hearts. And if we go deep enough, we find the Supreme Heart also, known as Purushottama or Paramatma or Antaryaman, the indwelling Lord within the heart. So we have a soul within our souls. There's a very unique conception in various traditions. There is something called the Holy Spirit or Espiritus Sanctus in Christianity, which kind of moves in that direction. But we have very literally the soul, the supreme soul residing within each soul. And if we go deeply enough within our own hearts, we find the Supreme Soul residing there. Very sublime, very beautiful image. So with bhakti yoga, the yoga of the heart, we have this process of loving God. Now, one of the things that we do, as I mentioned, is the recitation of God's names. And we are, in this setting, we particularly promote the chanting of those beautiful names of Hara, Krishna, and Rama. And it's in this kind of circuitous mantra, this mantra. Now, the mantra is, the whole purpose of a mantra is for meditation, right? A mantra is for yoga meditation, a meditation of going within to join with the object of meditation. To completely lose oneself in the object of meditation is known as samadhi. To attain a state of self-forgetfulness and to be utterly absorbed in the beloved object. This is samadhi. So that process is embedded within the Ras Lila, in the Ras Mandala, and in the conclusion of my book, I put forward that the Ras Mandala becomes sonically replicated in the Maha Mantra. That when the Maha Mantra is recited, you are in effect contributing to this dance, this circular dance. Have you noticed that the Maha Mantra, when you recite it, it just keeps going around and around and around? You notice that there are alternating feminine and masculine names, right? And there's a kind of rhythm back and forth, which is so nice. This is the sonic replication of the Ras Mandala. That is what we're doing. Prabhupada often talked about how Krishna dances on our tongues when we are reciting this mantra. Now, you could say this is a nice poetic thought. On the other hand, there really is something going on here. This is this what I call, in the end of the conclusion of this book, a kind of sonic replication of the Ras Mandala is what's going on. Even the beads, have you noticed? They're also round, right? And there's the one big bead, right? Krishna, right? And then the 108 gopis. Well, what do you think that's about? So, I mean, isn't this a little obvious? But it never gets quite said. I guess I'm here to say it. That the highest is also for everyone. I might add that when Srila Prabhupada published the first books he came out with, the Krishna book, this was containing the Ras Lila, and it was distributed all over the place. I mean, so on the one hand, it's the highest, and it's to be saved for that highest meditation. On the other hand, it is something on which we're always meditating every day, all the time. Those who take up the bhakti process and the recitation of God's names within the Maha Mantra. Srila Prabhupada also mentioned, and I'll just say a few more things. I don't want to extend this too long, and I invite any comments and questions, refutations, disputations, arguments. I'm sure Dwijamani has all kinds of stuff to say. I depend on him for that. Yes, and Pranava. No, I don't want to hear from him. I'll talk to him later. We have so much more to talk about later tonight. So, but really, from any of you, I'll simply say that this process of loving God in the Vaishnava tradition, and I spoke, I suppose, a little bit about this at the lectures at the University of Yotawari. I love saying that word. It's just great. How Krishna is not a god of judgment. He is not a god of punishment. He is not a god of fear. He is a very gentle deity. He is a very enticing deity. He's very beautiful. He attracts souls not out of threat or fear or guilt or sin, but out of beauty, out of love. This is a major statement in the theism of the Vaishnava tradition. Contrasting quite a bit, I think, what you have in Western traditions. But Then there's the responsibility for those who have taken up such a beautiful process as this to be able to find that that Krishna within the heart and to be able to extend that love that we find to others in a very friendly and wonderful way, a way of sharing. We talked about this a little bit in one of the lectures, that it behooves all lovers of God to share what they have when they love their God. Not that they have to be loving the exact same God, the particular manifestation of God. Srila Prabhupada mentions here that any manifestation of God can be loved on some level and can be reciprocated with. So, you know, who are we to say who someone should love? That is the heart that dictates who we love. However, if you can share with someone how much you love your God, your deity, your divinity, then that can inspire even more love. Love is contagious, actually. It's a very contagious thing. So if we love and we focus on our own hearts, then we have so much to offer others. So, so very much. So I think that what I'm basically talking about today is ultimately yoga is this joining of two hearts. That's the very highest yoga. Patanjali in the Yoga Sutra talks about this. The Bhagavad Gita is ultimately a book about yoga. It says it. Guhyam Param Yogam is the way the narrator of the Gita summarizes the whole teaching. The secret supreme yoga. Right in the conclusion of the text. Guhyam Param Yogam. Very clear. That yoga is love, ultimately. Before it gets to the heart, yoga then manifests in different other ways. Different disciplines for human souls and different manifestations of God. But when yoga is at its highest level, it is the heart of a human joining with the heart of God. This is the ultimate yoga. If we know this, then it behooves us to delve into it. And if we delve into it, then it behooves us to share it. Not impose it, but it's natural that we would share it. Because when we are in love, we sound like it. We look like it. There's no stopping it. You know, I have students coming into my class. Occasionally, you can tell there's a student in love in my class. You know, they're kind of there, but they're kind of like, they're sort of looking at me, but they're kind of like... And, you know, I don't ever look that nice that I get a gaze like that. It's not for me, that gaze. That's for somebody else. And the Vrajagopikas in their homes, they were gazing that way too. But it wasn't for their husbands or their relatives. It was for Krishna. It is a living in two worlds. That's the love mystic. Love mystic lives in two worlds. This one and the beautiful eternal world. And the love mystic knows how to bring that world into this one while we're on this very short sojourn in this life. We know how to import, as it were, from this other world and make it something that we can really join with other human hearts. The Rasmandala also, and I'll just finish on this, the Rasmandala also expresses this quite beautifully, because the way the Rasmandala commenced, the Rasa dance commenced, was first all of the ladies joined arms. It was only then, after they joined arms, then Krishna duplicated himself for each and every one of the gopis. Here's the secret, connecting with God means to connect with other humans first. I think sometimes we think, I'm giving up on humans. They're awful creatures. And we're not always very nice people. But they're awful creatures. Let me just focus on God. To heck with this human and that human. Humans are too difficult to deal with. Forget about them. I just want to deal with my relationship with God and just forget about the humans. But the Ras Lila tells us otherwise. He says, only when humans join together in a bond of affection, with bonds of affection, does God attend us so intimately and individually. But as soon as we compare ourselves with others, like the gopis did earlier in the Lila, they said, they stopped when they were playing on the banks of the Yamuna and they said, you know, we are the most fortunate women in the whole world. Now, that can sound grateful, but they were comparing themselves to other women. This is the downfall. As soon as we start comparing ourselves with others or ourselves, pride sets in, and what happens? God disappears. God disappears from the prideful soul. This lesson is taught twice in this short episode, this short lila. It's something apparently that we're supposed to learn about. As soon as we compare ourselves, God disappears. There's no room for love in a heart of pride. It's just that simple. Pride can be a very subtle thing. So the lila warns us in this way. That's where the disease of the heart begins, is with pride, and then it goes all haywire. Then you get lost, and it's just ridiculous, and it's hard to dig yourself out. But that's what we're here to do in this world. We're here to learn how to dig ourselves out of that, or to just become further buried in it. It's one or the other. So I just. Am I hearing music, or am I going mad, or is that actually something that's occurring? Oh. Do you all hear that, or am I just hearing it? Oh, good. I just never know when I'm going to just snap. You know, it's hard to say when that's going to happen with me, so it's just... Anyway, so let me... I've talked really long enough here, and let me just open up for any questions, comments, remarks, observations, really, from anybody. Any questions? We'll take a yes, Dwija, I knew I could depend on you.
Problematize.
Yes, let us.
This idea that we should, that the way to interact with and have dialogue with people who are coming from different traditions is to sort of open the heart and share our love for Krishna with them.
Yes.
But even in the examples you were giving about how when a person's in love, it's just apparent on their face. But the whole part of I think what that idea entails is the fact that lovers aren't totally sharing all the details of their love with anyone other than their beloved.
Mm.
That it is a very private thing. And particularly in the context of something like entering into interreligious dialogue, there are a lot of times people of other traditions who, if they hear about our appreciation of Krishna, would only become blasphemous.
Yes.
And so I'm wondering if that really is the appropriate way to approach dialogue with a person who doesn't have, you know, it's one thing to share, you know, if I have a brother and I love him, I can share that with my sister.
Yes.
Because the bond is common. But to share that with someone who doesn't have that common bond, it almost seems like you're opening something up to just be...
Yes. I feel this is a very valuable point. So therefore, but you gave the answer in your objection. Make everyone your brother and your sister.
Well, how to do that?
Ah. Thought you would never ask. Good. No, I'm teasing you, Dwija. Okay, so, I mean, there is a certain amount of withholding that goes on. In fact, Krishna himself does this. I was talking the other day about this secrecy, the divine secret, the secret love song. It's secret because Krishna withholds. He doesn't tell us so easily how much he loves us because that's sort of personal for him. And we're not really reciprocating terribly well often. At least in my case. So he doesn't let us know. Or he lets us know when we're ready. He's very eager. He's not just hiding this thing unnecessarily. And, you know, it's not a game of hide and seek. Well, kind of is hide and seek. Yeah. Well, anyway, that's another issue. But I think that it's natural that we would share what is most important to us in dealings. But yes, one has to first establish a relationship that can have that kind of transaction. So, you know, I totally agree with you. So once I get to know you a little bit more, you get to know me, we sit down for tea, then I might get to the point where I say, Dwija, can I tell you something about what I've experienced, you know? And then we naturally share it. I think it's natural as people become closer that they share these more valuable things. Not that you share everything. Like you said, the intensive encounters of love can be something that ultimately is just known and shared between lover and beloved. But there's so much else that one could say. The difference is, you know, but what do I do? Do I come to you and I say, by the way, Dwija, Krishna is God. And then you tell me. Well, I say, Allah is God. And then we both start putting frowns on our faces, and we don't necessarily keep drinking our tea. I have this urge to throw my tea at you, and somehow it becomes, you know, the quest for the is, right? The verb to be becomes the big argument, and we are trying to claim God, and we're comparing. You know, wait a minute. I'm someone who accepts this, and he's someone who accepts that. This is not good. Then the comparison comes in. Meanwhile, both of our gods have disappeared. And we're left to our own devices, and we generally hurt each other, and may the strongest person prevail. And then we're back here in the world of suffering. So befriending someone, making them a brother or sister, implied in your statement, is exactly our task. And I think that is one of the messages in the Ras Mandala, if I may be so bold as to interpret it that way, that we first have to join. Somehow we have to join hands with others and find the presence of divinity in their hearts. If you can't find it in their heart, chances are you're not finding it in your own. You can love in their heart what you find in yours first. And love in your heart, what you find in sometimes in another's very dear heart. It really begins, the locus of spiritual purity begins between persons. Sometimes we get stuck with this idea that someone is a pure devotee. Even Prabhupada is mentioning it here, pure devotees are ones who love God. But purity is not intrinsic. It's dialectical. It's what happens between us, Dwija. So if we're going to have tea together, you know, the purity is whether we relate to each other sweetly and can share in this way, or whether we end up throwing tea cups at each other.
Theological doctrine, or to begin by discussing one's love for the divinity in the way that one relates to the divinity, it seems like there may be cases in which neither of those will work as a starting point to build that friendship. Do you then have to build that friendship, if you're going to have interreligious dialogue, for instance, you have to start with secular dialogue and then work your way up?
I mean, sort of shoot the breeze, as we say in English.
The
main point is that if we know that there's some great treasure in this person's heart, I see this person, Dwija, and I'm seeing that there's somehow my Lord is going to speak through this other person. I feel this. And so I'm anticipating this. I'm excited about it. I'm eager for it. And so I have this subtle level of sort of affectionate expectation. Then it can be something that conjures up a certain level of spiritual attraction. And it almost, at one level, it almost doesn't matter what we say to one another. Because my motive, and everyone wants to know motive. When there's a killing, right, they always say, what was his motive in murdering all those people? Okay? The motive. Well, if the motive is to find love of God, then I don't really care what we talk about at one level. Ahaitukya pratiyatha bhakti. The whole point is unremitting, selfless love of God. Unremitting, unmotivated. Ahaituki, right? Ahaituki. We are motivated individuals. Everyone has motives. The only thing that can be called unmotivated is the motive to love God. That constitutes a non-motive because it's not motive in the sense of selfish. If what I want from you, Dvija, is your money, and I start talking about God and so on, and you know, you really like me because what I say about God, but then I say, so Dvija, I need some money. I'm on this European tour. I'm broke. They want me to speak at Oxford. I don't know how I'm going to get there. Oh, you mean we just had tea and everything, just you want my money? Yes, I want your money. So then that's not the end. The goal to love you and to love God, but rather I can talk to you about that for a while, and then I take your money and I run. It's a silly example, but then you see it's more subtle than that. Oftentimes in relationships, what needs do I have in a relationship? The need may be something other than the love itself. One scholar on love that I read a long time ago said, do I love you because I need you, or do I need you because I love you? The latter is better. I need you because I love you. I don't love you because I need you, you see. Bhakti is about needing God because you love him. Bhakti is about needing other souls with whom one can share this because they love souls and they love God. They love God within those souls, the soul within the souls. So it's really a question of how that affection manifests in regular everyday dealings. It comes right down to the heart at ground level. You know, not this lofty deistic, you know, the only one who's worth loving is God, and the rest of you, I don't like any of you. But it's just the opposite. And we know different statements, you know, Krishna says, you know, one who serves me is not my devotee, but one who serves the devotee is my, right? We have these statements. We have clear indications how it's so important to connect with the hearts of others. And in the Ras Mandala, of course, first there is the connecting with the hearts of others.
In last comment about this, it seems like there can be situations, or one would think that there might be situations in which it would, you know, dialogue with another person isn't really going to be possible because that other person is really only out to, you know, they want money from you, they want
yes.
to prove their thing. Although, but it seems from what you're saying that one way to sort of dissolve another person's disinclination toward what you love and would like to share is your actual interest in what they love and what they have to share.
Yes. Yes.
So in other words, if they're not a sort of willing participant, you can be the starting point.
Yes. Just like Krishna does with us. Oh, he manifests in all kinds of ways to get our attention. I mean, look in the 10th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. It said, of this, I am this. It manifests as the superlatives of this world. The beauty, the sun and the moon. Now, some people can look at the sun and the moon and say, there's the sun and the moon. Yeah. Right? But others can look at it and say, oh, the beauty there, the warmth, the one can become sensitive to how these are manifestations of divinity. And then one becomes attracted to the divine. So Krishna, just as Krishna tries to attract us in all kinds of ways until we can directly be attracted to him personally, we can also do that with others. So, you know, Dvijamani is kind of a stubborn creature, and he's got all kinds of motives, and he has so many needs, and this and that and the other. So I can be clever enough. If I really love Dvija, I'll be clever enough. I'm going to get him. Yeah, yeah. But not in that, you know, motivated sense, except that a motivation from the heart is qualified as a non-motivation. So it's in love that we find the answers to this. Out of love, it's not. It's very difficult, really. I quote at the end of this book the famous Latin poet Virgil, who is famous for saying, everyone knows this phrase, I think, at least in the West, or in the, where we are in the West, and in America. Love conquers all, right? Have you heard that expression? Love conquers all? The Latin poet, Virgil. But very few people know the second part of it. Love conquers all. So you too should be conquered by love. I like this statement. It's really good. And Vishwanatha Chakravarti, one of the great commentators within the Vaishnava tradition, says something very similar. I don't know whether he ever heard Virgil's line or not. But he says, once you see the smiling face of Krishna, allow yourself to be utterly conquered by it. So you too should be conquered by it. Love conquers all. So if I'm loving, I can conquer your, you know, motives and needs, and no problem. My problem is when I'm not being conquered by love myself. And then there will be problem. Then tea will be flying back and forth. I mean, you're right, Dvijaji. There are people that can be very. They're hurting. These are people who are hurting. These are people who need to protect themselves with a shield of doctrine. I need to know that I'm going to be saved, you know, by this deity or that deity, and I need to know that you're going to hell. I need to know that. I need you to go to hell because that makes me right. I need that. It's very important for me to know that you are going to hell for all eternity. I need to know that because that means I'm not. People will need that. They need to hang on to that. That's a suffering condition. That is not the love, the picture of supreme love in their tradition. Jesus, for example. Jesus did not say, there's no talk of hell in the New Testament? But do you know practically every Christian talks about hell? I'm maybe being, that's a generalization, and I apologize. But many Christians talk about hell. Yeah, I'm the Bible Belt. Exactly right. Yeah, yeah. We get a lot of it over there. That's right. In Sweden, you won't get so much. But you know, the point is, hell is where you lose your heart. That's hell. We can be in hell right now. Or we can be at the greatest level of heaven. I appreciate your comments. Yes?
You said that love isn't
intrinsic? Intrinsic?
I don't understand that.
Oh, I'm sorry. We think that the purity of heart just it resides with us and is up to us. But what I'm saying is it's between persons. Love must have a subject and an object. That's what I'm saying. And I appreciate your bringing this up because I didn't explain it clearly.
I don't know how many days I can use jet lag as an excuse, but I'm going to milk it for everything it's got, because I don't have that excuse when I lecture in the States. You know what I say? Car lag. You know, I mean, no one will accept. You know, I mean, how much of exertion does it take to drive from my house to the university? 7 minutes. You know, so there's no excuse. But here I can use jet lag. You see, very, very appropriately. But for how long, I'm not sure. But yes, the idea then is that love does not happen by oneself. Love only exists between two persons. So what we're speaking about then is the purity of love can't just be an individual enterprise, a lonely enterprise. It must take place between persons. So to say pure devotee has the a priori assumption that there are two people involved. To be pure of heart, pure in heart, means that there's some purity going on between hearts. Too often we think it's just intrinsic and it's just happening in me. He is a pure devotee, you know, just stands there by himself and he's not connected with anything. No, that's not the case. It's impossible. Purity of heart must take place between persons. Divine, human, whatever, must take place between persons. Does that make sense now?
Yeah.
Okay, great. I appreciate your inquiry. Good. Any other comments or questions or really about anything? Well, I guess we'll have to hear from Pranava, even though I've been talking with him all day. Yeah, that's right. Okay, Pranava, go ahead. Yeah. Yes.
I was wondering about, you spoke about love. It seems like if I challenge it a little bit in on level of emotion or a connection.
Please.
What about where does the understanding of service come in?
Yes.
Because Prabhupada many times he spoke about devotion, not service.
Service.
And it was kind of connecting that kind of emotion of love and heart-to-heart closeness.
Yes.
To something pretty much down to earth.
Yes. I very much appreciate that.
Yeah. Can you elaborate?
Yeah. The way I translate bhakti is the offering of one's heart, the giving of love. So it isn't just a passive thing. It's not that I sit there in meditation and I go, I love, you know, as an intransitive verb. No, I love, you know, there's an object. Love takes an object. There is love that doesn't take an object, the impersonal kind, the love of Aishwarya Bhava might be more of a passive love. I can love George Bush. Well, perhaps I can't. But whatever. We have our problems in America, you know? I have a lot of compassion for George Bush. No, I can't even say I have a lot of compassion. Anyway, I'm still working out my relationship with George Bush. Okay? This is one of my challenges, one of my problems. Okay? Somehow, I think he's there for me to learn how to love him, but I haven't found the way yet. Somehow. So, anyway, but the point is that love can be passive, but generally, really, what is promoted here is an active offering of the heart. Hearts that are reciprocate. There's an interaction. Emotional, a sense of feeling, but also there's a cognitive element to love. Tesham satata yukta nam bachatam priti purvakam dadami buddhi yogam tam yena mam ubayantite. When one loves, one knows someone better. But then you can't really love someone unless you know them. So it's sort of a kind of back and forth process. I mean, I heard someone walking across campus the other day, last week at the end of class, end of the semester. And I heard this girl say, you know, do you love such and such? And I said, no, I don't love him. I don't even know him. I said, oh, here, that was good. You know, sometimes it's nice to kind of eavesdrop a little bit what the students are saying because it's very edifying. Right? No, she doesn't love him. Why? Because she doesn't know him. So you must know something about that person, and then you can love them. When you love them, you know more about them. Premanjana churi tapaktivalochanena santasadaiva hridayeshu vilokayanti. Right? Yam shama sundaram achintya gunaswarupam govindam adipurusham tamahambhajami. Basically saying that when you know God with the eye of love, the prema netra, when the eyes are covered with the ointment of love, then you learn what you could never learn otherwise. The achintya guna swarupam, the incomprehensible qualities of the essential deity. So there's a cognitive element to love. So we know, we learn about someone, we love what we learn, we love that person, we know them more, and it's a certain kind of knowing. In the seventh chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, four kinds of people, right, come to divinity, but the one who knows God, the one who knows God, loves me the best. It's a loving kind of knowing, and it's a knowing kind of love, if I can say it that way. So yes, Pranavaji, love here is, there's actually a very practical thing. It's not a sentimental thing. It love is something that really is the connecting thing between humans. It connects humans. It joins humans together. Again, if love is based on a kind of mundane context and a need, so I join the exercise club. What do you call the exercise club? The gym. You have gym here? Good. So there, I join the gym club. Now, is that what you call it? No, the what is it called? The exercise.
It's called the gym.
Oh, gym. Okay, so I joined the gym club. Or some club, the gym. Whatever it is. Obviously, I don't know. Forget the club. Yeah, okay, good. Thank you for that. Okay, good. Just the gym. I joined the gym. And I just, you know, feel I love everyone at the gym. I mean, this is great. It sort of stinks, to it, but I can tolerate that. And, you know, it's a little smelly in the gym, but I get beyond that. I'm beyond the body at the gym, okay? I mean, I just love the gym. The people at the gym are wonderful, okay? And that's because they're all doing the same thing I'm doing, hitting the whatever they do. And I don't know what you do at a gym. But anyway, the point is, it was a terrible example because I'm sort of in an area that I have absolutely no authority about. I really don't know anything about gyms. But the point is that I love everyone at the gym because it's something I feel a part of. But you see, I'm loving these people on the basis of how they act and smell and whatnot, and these are not things that really are repositories of love. The issue is whether I'm connecting with others' hearts, whether I'm sharing something really deep. Now, sometimes I get to know someone while I'm playing tennis. Oh yeah, where's the tennis? Oh yes, very good. Ah yes, okay. So if he and I go out to play tennis, and of course he finds out I don't look like much of a tennis player, but he finds out that I am a tennis whiz. I am actually not, I confess. You know, the chairman of my department took me out to play tennis. In fact, I got the job, the teaching position, on the basis of whether I would play tennis or not with him. It ultimately came down to that. You know, he said, are you willing to go out on the court with me? I said, oh, yes, because my job obviously depends on it. And he said, yes, it does. And so I agreed, and I went out on the court once, and that was it. He found out what a lousy tennis player I am. So he never wanted to. He ended up teaching me how to, you know, keep the arm and, you know, hit the. It was terribly awkward. I don't know why these. I mean, just whack the ball. I mean, the ball's flying at you. Just hit the thing. Anyway, I'm not so skilled at this. You know, there are other areas that I'm a little more skilled in. Tennis is not one of them. But the idea is that if we go out to play tennis and we get to know each other a little bit that way, then that's nice. Then maybe that's an opportunity to delve more deeply into, or we could just stay tennis players. We could just stay tennis partners. We can keep things on that level. I go to a job, and I sit next to someone I like a lot. He's a great guy, or she's a great gal, or whatever. You can keep it on that level. You know, we're at the same job. We kind of we complain, we criticize the boss, you know, and that somehow makes me feel comfortable. It's no different than, you know, criticizing others for not believing in what I believe in, right? So, you know, we can get that sort of corroboration. But really, where's the heart? Human beings have a tendency to not want to connect. They fear intimacy. They don't know how to turn to the person and say, oh, you know, we've complained about the boss for the last hour, you know, and so on. But then, you know, how do we turn to someone and say, what's really important to you? I'm interested. What do you love to do? We don't know how to do that so easily. And then if they tell us, it's kind of scary. Like, wow, you'd love to do that, huh? What about the next step? What do you love about that? Go deeper. If you take it deeper and deeper and deeper, eventually it gets to the heart. It gets to ultimate things. You can move things in that direction. So it doesn't matter with whom you come in contact. Move them in the direction of going deeper into the heart. It doesn't matter who you sit next to, talk to, encounter at the food store, you know, or the bookstore, wherever. Yeah.
Well, to take it a step further, and addressing Pranava Prabhu's question about devotional service, about serving, are you saying that, or have you mentioned, and I missed it, that service is a way to connect? I mean, how does it tie in with what Prabhupada said about devotional service?
Well,
I'm not sure you've answered this question yet.
Well, service, well, it's the offering of the heart is the way I define service.
Through service.
Well, you can, yeah. However, you can offer the heart through, I mean, it depends on what service. Sometimes people hear service, they think of what we call the service station, which in America means a gas station. You know, the auto fuel, right? Everyone knows what I'm talking about. You have gas stations here. Right? yes, you have. Okay, good. So, it's my first time in Sweden, you know, so I don't know these things. Okay. So, actually, I've seen very little of Sweden because I've just been buried in Pranava's dissertation. So actually, I've seen very little. Even coming here in the bus, we were talking so much, I didn't even know what was outside the... Right?
You saw some buildings.
I saw some buildings. So I know there are buildings in Sweden. I can report home, Sweden has buildings. But that is all I can say. But you've gone elsewhere and seen other things. Okay, so... But basically, there is... Service can, I believe what Prabhupada meant by service is some way to offer one's heart, to give to that other person. I think giving to the person who sits next to me in the job is to really give one's interest, one's, well, one's heart, one's love, one's to ultimately to be fascinated with the mystery of other persons' hearts. What's there's a treasure in there. There's divinity in there. How can I connect with that person? What can I hold on to that will give me greater access to that person's heart? Yeah.
Well, what if everyone who comes to this kind of gathering is so busy offering their hearts to each other that, you know, the prasadam doesn't get cooked? The cafe closes down because no one's taking care of the guests who come because they're so busy exchanging each other's hearts.
Yes, yes.
Isn't there a practical
No, but then there would be no need to get anything else done. That would be perfect. But because that doesn't happen, we have these other things.
And that's a way of connecting.
Yes.
It's a way, it's an offering.
Yes. There are those other things. Yes, then there's the generous cooking, and then there's the beautiful worship, and then there's so many things. But if we were all sharing perfectly that way, there would be no need for any of it. I mean, everything would be there. The sharing is there. That's what goes on in the spiritual world. That's what goes on in the eternal world. I mean, this perfect sharing. That's called rasa. But yes, we could close down the restaurant. Yes, exactly. Yes, Pranava, you tell the temple president, you can close down the restaurant if there is this complete, perfect sharing going on. Until then, keep it open. There's no problem then. You keep it open.
But Vishadam is such a beautiful way to share.
Well, yes. There are plenty of ways to offer one's heart. And there are the six exchanges between bhaktas explained in Rupa Goswami's Upadeshamrita. So there are loving exchanges. It's not that you just sit there and gawk at each other. You know, remember, Dwija and I are having tea. I bought him tea. Right? Now, it ended up in a kind of a nasty encounter. But those are the risks you have to take, you see? Those are the risks. But the most important thing is that there is a warmth exchanged between hearts. And yes, there can be these various activities together. I remember when my son... I mean, imagine how Krishna feels. I meditated on this one. I thought about this once. My son, when he was five, he went into my study, stole some paper from my desk, in fact, something that had some important things on it, but stole it, stole a pencil, drew on the back of it a happy birthday sort of card, right? And he comes running to me and gives it to me for my birthday. Okay, now just understand what he did. He went and plundered my study, okay? He stole my pen, he stole my piece of paper, and then he's giving it to me as if it's a present to me? Well, I mean, it was a very loving thing to do, right? None of this world belongs to us. Even our own bodies don't belong to us. We call them our bodies. Well, you didn't choose to come into it. I mean, you found yourself in that machine. So, in a sense, to offer what is not ours is a little ridiculous, isn't it? On the other hand, that's all we've got. But it's a vehicle for conveying the feelings of the heart. And that's the justification. Now, if he gave it to me, you know, if my son gave it to me and just threw it at me, you know, take that, I would have said, "Who?" Well, at least you could have used your own paper and your own pencil if you're going to be that way. But what we have is what already belongs to the eternal world. It doesn't belong to us. The only thing that God does not own and control is our hearts. It's the only thing. It's the only thing we actually have to offer. So the offering of the heart can mean, I love you very much, I'll give you a book, a present. I have a present for you. Right? Or we can take a nice dinner together. There are plenty of people that come to dinner and hate each other. Even taking sacred foodstuffs, and they can still hate each other. If it's not, if the affection is not issuing forth from the heart, then we're not able to understand the affection issuing from the heart of God to us. So I think that's our process. I think that's the process of any tradition that focuses on the essence. I've been studying these religious traditions for years, teaching them for years, and my conclusion is that there is a secret love song. He keeps it secret because we're not ready to hear it. We need to fight about our traditions. We need to kill some people. We need to hurt each other. It's horrible. It's horrible what we do to one another. Horrible. In the name of religion, it's like taking a beautiful flower and like smashing it into someone's face. I mean, you know, and suffocating them with a flower. You know? I mean, who would think to use a flower to suffocate someone with? I mean, just that's what goes on in religion. I will take this greatest gift of the heart and kill people for it. It's so, so inconceivable. But leave it to humans. We manage to do this. It bespeaks our suffering condition that we resort this way. It just, it's like taking gold, and gold is very heavy, and then, you know, knocking Dwija on the head with it. I mean, gold is heavy, so it's useful that way. You can hurt someone with it. But it's gold. Humans can misuse anything. We're expert. But we're afraid of looking in our hearts. We're afraid to, and we're afraid to share them. Any other comments or... Am I going over here? What's happening here? I never reset my watch to Swedish time, so I have to add 6. Okay, 6 plus 12:30, 6:30. We're 6:30? Is this going on too long? I fear that maybe this is being stretched a little bit here. Okay, are we talking about anything important? I think a little bit, right? A little bit important, right? Any other comments or questions? Dwija, be nice now. No, come on. Okay, come on. No, don't be nice. Let's...
Just thinking of what you're saying, one could think that what Arjuna did was to smash the Kauravas in the face with flour.
Uh-huh.
The flour of Krishna's instructions in the Bhagavad Gita.
Right.
He takes that.
Yes.
And I mean, it seems that that's the prototype of using religion as the motivation to kill someone.
Yes. This is a very difficult subject, and a subject on which I've focused quite a bit. And as you know, Satyaraj... No, it's good. No, Satyaraj, you know, did that book on the holy war,
yes.
Right? Violence in the Bhagavad Gita, right. And I wrote the foreword to that. And in my translation of the Bhagavad Gita, I talk about Kim Kuravata Sanjaya. How did they act, O Sanjaya? The key issue is how should one act in the most treacherous of human circumstances, in the most miserable of human circumstances. And amazingly, the ultimate message here of the Gita is one should act out of love. Even in the most miserable circumstances. And war, I don't think there can be any more miserable circumstance than war. And I take that a little further and I start, sort of analogizing it a little bit and say that we all have our own battlefields. You know, we're all kind of at war, especially at rush hour. Do you have something called rush hour here? With traffic? You do. You have rush hour, yeah. You know what I mean by rush hour, right? Okay, good. We have that expression in America. I don't know. Rush hour. How do you say in Swedish? Does nisnafik? No, I have to learn this term. No, say it again. Okay. Yeah, I can see I'm going to have to work at Swedish. It's not going to be an easy language for me to learn. Sanskrit I can learn. The Swedish is a little difficult for me. Yeah, it's a little difficult for me. Thank you for that contribution. Can we talk after you repeat it about 25 times? I'll get it. Okay, I will. That's my next phrase after a Yodobori. I've mastered that. Now I move on to the... And we learned another one. Absolute. Huh?
Absolute.
Yeah.
Right,
and apelsinus. Apelsinus.
Orange juice.
Right. Did you recognize what I was saying? Apelsinus? Sort of. I didn't quite master that one. Yes. If religion is used as a means, and the end would be a political one, then Arjuna is simply, then he's losing no matter what the outcome of the war is. If the essence of religion is pursued for its own sake, then he wins no matter what. Then we win the battle of being here in this material world. Suffering is guaranteed here. We are always going to suffer here. This is not a pleasant place. People get hurt, bodies get torn. We're set up for suffering here. I mean, it's just perfect. It's perfect. We can hear about, see, experience the most amazing kinds of suffering and torment and torture. Horrible things happen in this world. Horrible things. This is, quite a privileged country here. I mean, it's pretty peaceful here, more peaceful than the U.S., I'll tell you that. The U.S. is a battlefield. It's kind of a strange place. But it doesn't matter where One is, the greatest form of impoverishment is the hunger of the heart. It affects affluent countries like Sweden. It affects poor countries like, you know, Kenya or wherever. It doesn't matter. It's the greatest form of poverty in the world is the hunger of the heart. It hits everybody. If we solve that problem, the hunger of the body would be solved. With a pure heart, we become very generous. We don't become selfish. Our inspiration, our love, our energy comes from giving to others. There would be no hungry people on this planet if the hunger of the heart was solved. So the poverty begins in the hearts of so many of these leaders who don't understand what their job is first, is to make an atmosphere, a country, at least able to pursue the life of a heart, the life of the heart. So perhaps this sounds idealistic, but in the Bhagavad Gita, I don't know, that sounds pretty idealistic too. I mean, you're in war, and Arjuna is being asked to go within his heart. Because on an outside, outer level conflict, there's no resolution to this ethical conflict, as we talked the other day. There will always be ethical conflicts no matter what in this world. Irresolvable ethical conflicts. The only answer really to that too is to go within the heart, deep within the heart, and to come back with strength of heart.
It seems then that the line between, you know, using religion, which is like this form of flower to suffocate a person, and actually having legitimate holy war where you're killing someone out of love in the way that Arjuna was doing on the battlefield of Kurukshetra, it seems that it's a very subjective one, and that sort of in this, because there's this portrayal of religion as, you know, the worst thing that's happened to humanity, and just you give this list from the Crusades down
absolutely
to the shindig in Iraq.
Absolutely.
And it seems that there's a lot of room for sort of the question of what was really in the hearts of, you know, from the leaders of these wars down to the soldier fighting on the front line, as to whether it was a legitimate holy war or whether this was, you know, religion being used as it always is to as an excuse to kill people.
Yes. No, it's the Gita has been accused of, you know, that kind of situation where it's a holy war. It's a, you know, it's a righteous, even the Gita itself says dharmyam yudham. You know, dharmyam yudham. It's a righteous fight. You know, it's a dharmic. It's a dharmic fight. Presumably here in this situation, because innocent people are being ruled by an evil king. And they need to be protected. And so one fights. For example, if someone comes in here and tries to hurt you, I think it would be reasonable for me to get up and try to stop them, you know. Maybe not whack them first, but, you know, at least stop them from hurting you, right? And I'm kind of a big, tough guy, and I would do, well, I don't know, I'd send him, he's got the tennis arms. I'd send him over there. Petter, is that your name?
Yeah,
Petar. So I would send Petar over there, and you know, he would save you. You'd feel more secure with him, I'm sure. But the idea would be, these are difficult circumstances in this world. How to act out of love in a very treacherous world. But if there's any way to act in this world, the Gita is saying the best way is with a full heart. To act with no heart can mean, even in those situations, we've learned, I think, from the Vietnam days, which dates me, I'm sort of the last generation of the 60s, that, you know, there can be brutality in war, even. I mean, you know, there could be a nice way. I mean, the Gita is a nice war. I mean, in one sense, I mean, well, I mean, not really. I mean, when you get into it, but at least it's chivalrous in the sense that all the warriors gather together. They go to a certain area, a holy place, no less, and they line up like chess pieces, right? And when they say go, they go. So it's warriors fighting warriors. It's not like someone, you know, coming into Yotobori and beginning to, you know, plant a bomb. You know, it's cowardly. It's not a cowardly war. It's set up to be a war for warriors. Okay, and, you know, there are people that will do that. They'll fight because that's what they're meant to do. The details of the Mahabharata war and all that is a different issue. But the message, the essential message here is that here, it's very fair. They're lined up to fight. They don't take old men like me and their fuddy-duddy scholars and expect them to fight. Because what could I do? Even when I was in the draft of Vietnam, the last year of the draft, they realized that the gun was heavier than my body and they would never have taken me because I was a very thin, little, frail thing. So certain people are made to be warriors. And the Gita talks about this. The Gita talks about the ashram varna. Varna, right? Varna dharma. So there are warriors, and they are supposed to do that. Here, he just didn't expect to be fighting against his own family members and teachers. So it was an ethical conflict. It was a depressing situation for Arjuna to encounter. But I think that this is important for all of us because we have irresolvable issues in this world. Things that just, no matter what you do, it's never going to be right. Whatever you do. So then how do you deal with that? The Gita is saying, with a full heart, as full a heart as possible. Go deep within and,
how can you reach this full heart inside of you? How do you do it?
Yes.
Practically.
Practically, there is a process of practicing love. I'm sure he wasn't born a good tennis player. I know that. He practiced. Don't tell me that you came out of the womb playing tennis. Natural. You practice. Okay, good. Right. So even if you have talent with that, you still practice. And so it's a question of actually practicing the actions of the heart. But we'll do everything to avoid that. Even in education, you can go through and get a whole PhD. Take Pranava, okay? What has he learned about love in his education? Nothing. Where did you go, Pranava?
He's hiding.
Oh, very good. Okay. Oh, he's talking. Okay. So you can go through a whole PhD program and learn nothing about how to live the life of the heart. And for that matter, you can go through a whole education and not learn how to balance a checkbook or change the oil in your car. Or know how to revive someone who has fainted on the floor with CPR. You can go through a whole education and not learn these most practical things. Shame on the Western educational system. But most of all, the thing that we need most, the thing that we come into the world seeking, love, the thing that we search for, consciously or unconsciously, whether we know it or not, never gets addressed. We're not trained how to live the life of the heart. Everything trains the life of the heart if we see it that way. Everything teaches us how to live the life of the heart. When we meet someone nasty, they're teaching us how important it is to live the life of the heart. When we meet someone who's very loving and very warm, they teach us how wonderful it is to live the life of the heart. When we read texts such as these that give us great visions of love, they teach us about the life of the heart. And then there are the love mystics who teach us you were talking about service, how to practice the life of the heart. How to practice that life in relation to other humans and to divinity.
And then you would be less afraid.
Yes, yes, yes. Just like Petter is not very afraid to go on the tennis court, whereas I'm absolutely frightened out of my gourd. I mean, I wouldn't touch. I would not go near a net. What is it called? A net. Yeah, very good. I would not even touch a racket, tennis racket. Too afraid. But yes, when one practices, when one makes a concerted effort of living the life of the heart, becoming good at it, tennis player, then you go on there and it's natural. And then you take it everywhere you go. I'm sure when Petter is walking down the sidewalk, he's practicing his stroke. You know, probably hitting people on the way. But it's out of love, you see, for the game. It's out of love for the game. Now, with tennis, that's not so good. But with the life of the heart, you can practice that anywhere. In fact, we need to practice that everywhere. That's the one thing you do practice everywhere, even in your dreams. It's the only thing, really, you can do everywhere, anytime, all the time. Tennis, we limit it to the, keep it in the court. Don't practice it in the hall, Prasadam Hall there. It's not good. It's the only full-time thing. Yeah. Wait, let me just say, did you have...
It seems to be so easy, so why don't people just do it?
I think you're exactly right. It's so easy and so natural, but so difficult to get down to. Because there are all kinds of things. The thing that makes it hard are the disappointments of the heart, the hurts of the heart. We come into this world expecting love from parents. And even in the most loving relations with parents, they always disappoint us. We're always let down on some level. So this is the first, you know, experience of a kind of lost love, a loss in love. And then we learn to have friends. And we have friends, we have our first friends, and then a friend turns on us. We get hurt again. And then life seems to be a series of disappointments of the heart. And then maybe we say, just forget about it. Or we say, I'm going to keep looking. I know there's some higher love here. I just need to learn how to do that. I've not been successful, but I need to keep striving. And then maybe I want to look for ultimate love, the ultimate source of love. Where is that? Maybe that can even be part of my love on this plane. Maybe ultimate love is available on this plane. The love mystics say it is so. The love mystics say, yes, you can find such powerful love in the hearts of anyone. Love also may extend to other creatures, not just humans. Not that you talk to an ant. I'm not suggesting that. But that you don't hurt the ant. You understand that life is love. And love is life. And that you have respect for all living creatures. That's part of being sensitive to the heart, is being sensitive to the pleasure and pain of other creatures, not just humans. To participate in the life of all creatures, not the pain of other creatures. In this world, it's inevitable. You know, you just walk through the door, you know, you bump into someone that you cause them pain. I mean, I do that all the time. I'm so clumsy. I run into things. And you know. So pain is there. But to intentionally do it is another thing, to do it knowingly, to participate in the life of, well, pain and hurt and ultimately death is terrible. So if one hopes for any connection with the heart, one purifies one's way of doing things as much as possible. We cannot. The goal here is not to live a perfect life in this world as if we were living in a divine world. That will never happen here. But to be as conscientious as possible and considerate of all living beings, especially one's fellow human being, but all human beings. Yeah, how about that? All other creatures, sentient creatures, is an important feature of being sensitive. to one's own heart as well. It's a total orientation in one's life. That's why many here, for example, are vegetarian. They will be participating in the least amount of harm to all living creatures. Because you cannot expect happiness when you are participating in the suffering of other creatures. Even at home, we have what's known as the bug cup. You know, a major wasp, you know, about this big comes in the house. Or at least it seems it's that big, right, at the time. Because it has that long kind of ugly body, you know, with the little end with a stinger hanging off the stomach. You know, I don't know, I'm not an entomological expert here. But, you know, it's flying around and it's kind of swooping down. It kind of just misses you and, whoa, you know. Okay, well, the fact is that's quite a body to inhabit. I wouldn't, you know, I have compassion for the creature. But instead of taking a newspaper and, you know, smacking it, you know, well, it's always a contest. Like, who's going to do the bug cup, right? And usually it's according to who did it last and, you know, that kind of thing. But, you know, we get the cup, we put the bug in the cup, we take the cardboard, put it very gently, right? Don't hurt his legs. Very gently, behind the cup. And then the other person has to run and open the door. Okay? And then the issue is how to release this vicious bug who could kill you in one... You know, remember, it's this big. Right? So then you run outside, and then you... And then the bug will suffocate if you keep it in the cup. So you have to do something. You know. So a couple of times when I've been very cowardly, I take a broomstick and I just kind of like hit the cup over. Other times, recently, I've been so brave, I just kind of hit the cup and the bug flies away. So you know, it's a little extra trouble to do that sort of thing. But to learn a respect for life. And to practice it. Yeah.
I was just thinking also that some of these books, all of the books, but some in particular, maybe the pastimes of, you know, the life of Lord Chaitanya specifically teaches how to live a life of love like that. And they're so inspiring to read about these. Pastime.
Yeah.
The golden colored books on the
right here.
Which one?
I don't know if that's
Chaitanya Charitamrita.
Chaitanya Charitamrita.
Oh, all of them. Okay. I mean, the first, the Adi Lila is a little technical. It may not, you know, be an easy place to dive into it, but the Madhya Lilas are very, to see the interaction of these great devotees of the 16th century and so on. And again, to look at, the love mystics. How they acted, and the great visions, you know, of supreme love, these are all we become what we associate with. So keep associating with loving hearts, loving visions, loving instruction. How can you go wrong? Don't go to University of Göteborg. There are no loving hearts. The only one who's there is Prana. Yeah. Do not go to that place. It is the most unloving place I've ever seen in my whole life. No, they're all that way. Harvard was the worst of all. In fact, I hate that place. It's just awful what they did to me up there. And but seriously, no matter where you go, associate with, connect with, or be in contact with. Loving sources, or find the loving source within people. If it's not there, then find it or create it. If you can't, then maybe best to stay away, you know. But if you can create it, that's good. Or if it's already created and you can benefit from it, that's also good. Again, choose your life. Make your life a life of the heart, which is the only real religion. Everything else is idolatry. Idolatry? Oh, idolatry, you know, like idol, when something is an idol. Idolatry is when you make something more than what it is. You exaggerate it. And blasphemy would be the opposite. You make something less than what it is. You see? So religion without this core of love becomes idolatry. It becomes empty worship. It becomes something else. It becomes another animal, so to speak.
And perhaps you could say a little something about bhakti yoga specifically, because I know that Muriel has been looking at different types of yoga.
Mm.
And, you know, even explaining what bhakti yoga
yes.
is specifically.
Yes. Well, the bhakti yoga process is that process which focuses specifically on cultivating the life of the heart. We mentioned the recitation of God's names. This is one of the most, well, it's probably the most important process of purifying the heart, dancing within one's heart. It's the life of the heart. It is in the most essential way. But also, again, with whom you associate, the people you come in contact with is very important. Finding someone who can guide guide is very important in this process. As I'm sure Petra had a teacher of, don't tell me you just picked up tennis, Matt. You had teacher at tennis, right? Ah, see? Just see. Teacher was there. You see? So it's good to always have a teacher, someone who's experienced, someone in whom you can place trust, that they know how the life of the heart is cultivated. So it's important. And there are often many teachers, many different teachers in different ways. So, yeah, these are all part of the process. And again, in this particular path of bhakti yoga, then there will be various things that you can do. And then you learn from teacher as best. Yeah. Let's see, 1 + 6 = 7. It's 7 o'clock. So I think maybe this has gone on way too long for everyone's health. I think this is going to become a health hazard sitting here any longer. Yes, one could be short of oxygen. One could, you know, there are many different health.
We'll get Garuda lagged.
That's right, exactly. Yeah, while I'm jet lagged, it'll be Garuda lagged. That's right, exactly. But look, it's been a pleasure to come into to see this this very very sattvika, very beautiful center, and you know, maybe I'll come here. Well, am I coming here? I'm coming here maybe in 2 years.
Yeah.
If you ever finish that dissertation.
If I ever finish that.
Yes. Yes. Yes, your Göteborg University dissertation. Mm. You see, I tried to use the the name as much as possible. Yeah, yes, good. Well, look, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to work with all of you.
Thank you very much yes. for taking the time and visiting us.
Yeah, no, it's my pleasure. My pleasure.